Star Wars, the adventure continues. As Return of the Jedi ends, an exciting new saga begins. Brought to you by the writer Kathy Tyers, this is the Truce Epicura.
You are listening to Fanthatrax.
Powered by Fanthatrax.com. It's the Fantha from down under.
G'day folks, how you going? Welcome to the one, the only, the Fantha from down under. We're getting to the show very, very quickly here. As we're going to be talking about, of course, as it said in the intro, The Truce of Bakura, one of the first novels I picked up post Return of the Jedi. That's right, one of the very first. And of course it takes on all the story immediately after Return of the Jedi, folks. Right, let's get into it on the mullet. And here comes Mark Newbold. Let's get into it. And this here's how you can find the Fantha from Down Under on the World Wide Web. You can catch Adam O'Brien, the Fantha from Down Under, at The Lethal Mullet on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can also catch him on the Lethal Mullet podcast on Phantom Podcast Network. You can also catch him on Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast on Phantom Podcast Network. You can also catch him at The Mullet Guild on the Phantom Podcast Network at fbnet.podbean.com. Be sure to check out all the listings there and subscribe for the great shows also at fantatracks.com. It's all your Star Wars news in a single file.
No sooner has Darth Vader's hero power burned to ashes on Endor, then the Alliance faces a new challenge at the far-flung Imperial outpost of Bakura, the Siruk, a race of cold-blooded reptilian invaders plan to enslave human minds to pilot their invincible machines of war and destruction, with the hope of turning Bakura's loyalties toward the fledgling New Republic with defensive aid. Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, and Princess Leia race to the besieged planet. Yet, as the eve of the final slaughter rapidly approaches, Rebel and Imperial forces still must come to terms with each other, and there is already evidence of a traitor hidden in the mist.
All right, folks, it sounds like our dear pal from the UK, all the way from Birmingham, is now ready. He's had his cup of tea, he's had his breakfast, and of course he's ready. Now that he's in the past, of course, because we're in the future here in Australia, Quinlan's Cantina, here to chat some Truce of Bakura, let's head into the pub here at Fantha from Down Under. Now it's time to go down to the pub here with the Fantha from Down Under. Let's go grab a pint.
We're good to go.
We're good to go. All right, folks, welcome back to Quinlan's Cantina here. Joining me live from Birmingham, and yes, that is across the pond in the UK, our dear friend, one of the many head honchos, of course, of Fantha Tracks. You can find that where you find all your Star Wars news in a single folder, fanthatracks.com. It is the one, the only, the co-host also of Making Treks on, of course, the Fandom Podcast Network. The one, the only, the indomitable, the strong, the powerful, and one hell of a bass player, Mark Newbold. Pal, how are you?
I'm good after that introduction, mate. That was awesome. I should have you following me around all day, just making proclamations of my own. That was very good. Very good.
And, well, it is true, folks. We have a lot of fun over there in the other place too. So go and check out Making Treks, where we talk about something other than Star Wars, but Star something else, isn't it?
It certainly is. Yeah, we are having some good fun with that. I think recently we talked about Wrath of Khan and Space Seed and the whole that whole little thread of stories in Star Trek, which was great fun. So, yeah, looking forward to this. It's been a long time since you and me talked Star Wars. I think would have been on Ozfans maybe, or Jodcast. I forget which one came first now.
Jodcast was first, yeah, and we haven't done proper Star Wars, even though we're on the same network, since, yeah, it would have to be Ozfans, which is going back to 2016 maybe.
Good grief.
That's only a little bit ago. Now, before we get right into it, folks, tonight we are going to be chatting about one of the greatest, I think, beginning novels. This is a novel that just gets you kick-started, gets you a little bit of a Star Trek flavour to this, especially with the bad guys, but it really gets the big trio out there facing something else. When they thought they'd taken everything out in Return of the Jedi, it just kicks off straight away. It is also called The Truce at Bakura, and written by Kathy Tyers, isn't it, from 1994.
Scary how long ago that is. It's probably been that long since I read it from cover to cover, you know. I mean, it was great, like you say, coming off the back of the Heir to the Empire trilogy, and Dark Horse were doing their stuff by that point, and Star Wars was really starting to ramp up again. And then Truce suddenly turns up. You know, I think I can't remember where I first heard about it. It was probably in The Insider, I would imagine. Happy days. It was a good time to be a Star Wars fan. It's always a good time to be a Star Wars fan, but then, the mid-90s particularly, it was just starting to build up nicely. Trek had the run of it in the 90s. You'd say 90s belonged to Trek, I would say. But in that sense, Star Wars was just starting. It was just before the Hasbro figures started coming out. I think Bendems were just with us, and a few licensees were getting stuff. And, yeah, it was all starting to build up again. So, yeah, it was a good time to be a fan.
It really is. And, of course, this is one for me. When I first came across it was at a time where I'd seen some of the ads in other Dark Horse material. I was following the Predator comics, the Aliens, and then all the Versus series. So you had Batman versus Predator and Terminator versus Aliens, all these crossovers, the many licenses that Dark Horse owned at the time. Oh, that was a good one too. Yeah, love that one.
Yeah.
But they had all these other great 20th Century Fox, mainly, items in their catalogue of licenses they were producing. And then I saw one of the Tom Veitch, Cam Kennedy ones, which, of course, was Dark Empire. I saw the little framed beautifully. I mean, Paul Bateman would know this better than us. I don't know if it's ink wash or just watercolour he was using, but he'd pick three or four colours and then just smash it against the black and white that he was going through. And they were just absolutely gorgeous pieces of artwork. You knew the faces, you knew the struggles, you knew it was, you know, the Emperor in there, and you knew there was a Luke Skywalker that was going to the dark side. You know, this was true Jedi fiction. But those ads really captured my imagination. That's where it was that I really kicked back in. What about you?
Same. I mean, you know, we'd had what now, it wasn't at the time, but what they now refer to as the dark times. You know, from sort of 87 when the Bantha Trax magazine sort of wrapped up, and before it became the Lucasfilm mag, and it was just a bit of a break, you know, and Lucasfilm were focusing on things like Willow Labyrinth and Tucker and things like that, and ILM was the focus, and Western Games had just released Star Wars the role-play game. So that's what kept me and my crowd busy in those pre-internet days. So we were Star Wars in like three nights a week. So for us, there was no dark times. It was Star Wars all the way, but it was our own stuff. But for the wider world, you'd look at sort of Dark Empire, Heir to the Empire, that era, with it coming back. And of course, both those stories were set, I think Heir was 5 years after Dark Empire was six, or it might be the other way around. I might be back to front with those two, but they were certainly both a few years after Jedi, pretty much where The Mandalorian sits now, funny enough. And it was thrilling in the sense of like this, and it was very much sold to us as this is what happened next. You know, this is the further adventures of. There's no doubt that this was what we now call canon. It wasn't really considered that then. Even then, we'd kind of ignored the Marvel run and stuff like that. But it was the, you know, the thing. And then, of course, Truce comes out, which is set, like, feels like it was a couple of days after the end of Return of the Jedi. So, again, that takes you, that gave you parameters for storytelling in that, you know, we're going to fill in this sort of 5 or 6 year gap or whatever it was, you know, between Jedi and Heir to the Empire and Dark Empire. So, yeah, it was a really good time to be a fan. Fascinating stuff to read. And they weren't throwing stuff at you at a million miles an hour either, so you actually had time to read it.
It really is. All these novels were well, brought it to us when it comes to the way they were designed. They really had the Star Wars flavour. Now, Timothy Zahn, obviously, really kicked this off for us and gave us three novels that I think, you know, really captured a lot of the imagination of what George had come up with the original trilogy. But I think when they had that template for, you know, success when it came to the adventure, the myth, the excitement also, that's one of the things that I have to say is lacking in some of the newer material that's out there, excitement, you know. I think we look at comic book for movies these days and there's a certain amount of grit and a certain amount of, you know, getting it down to its bare essentials so it's realer and all that sort of stuff. Forgetting that we're making something that is to entertain, not just to be. This is a lesson in life, you know, all that sort of stuff. What these books really did was they did that subliminally. You still got some great messages, obviously, about which is what Star Wars is about. George is a teacher. He always was. But I think in these ones, it was done in such a way that you got the romp, the pageantry, the romance of Star Wars in these novels. And I think Truce Bakura does exactly what the Thrawn trilogy does, but it does it in one bloody novel.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, because we, at the time, it had been, what, where was it, 94 this came out, so 11 years since Jedi. You know, he'd had Ewoks and droids and you know, a couple of seasons of Ewoks and droids, and even they were sort of 10 years in the rearview mirror, and the Ewoks movies were 10 years back. So live-action Star Wars, I don't think we'd even had the board game, which had a little bit of live-action stuff in it by this point, if I can remember. So, you know, it was going back, you were going back quite a way, and sort of this point of the 90s, it was when Fox were kind of constantly re-releasing. Here's the remastered versions of Star Wars. Here's the widescreen versions of Star Wars. They were very much sort of revamping and re-releasing Star Wars an awful lot. I think we were just before the THX versions. But nevertheless, so you saw Harrison a lot on the big screen. You saw Carrie on various things. You didn't see Mark so much because he was doing more stage work and his vocal career was really starting to take off at this point. But you saw the other guys. So, and they still looked pretty much like they did when you last saw them in Jedi. So we were ready for these adventures of Han, Luke and Leia, and it was all about Han, Luke and Leia because we're still 5 years ahead of the prequel trilogy at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was, you wanted an adventure, you wanted the little cameos, and you did want what people now very negatively call fan service, which I think is a ludicrous concept because if you're not keeping the fans happy, what the hell are you doing? You know, it's not Michelangelo, it's pop culture, it's fan, it's... You know, it's art for fans, essentially. You know,
of course it is.
You know, you throw Wedge in for like three frames of The Rise of Skywalker and enough people in the crowd go, oh, my God, it's Wedge. You know, you've won then. That's like, that's a thumbs up. You've got the pulse racing. You've got people going, oh, yeah, Wedge, you know. I remember those X-Men novels. And that's the sort of thing that works when it's done right, of course. You can go to the well too many times and do it wrong. At this point of time, 26 years ago, it was all new to us again, and we were ready for it. You know, Air had done phenomenal business. I think all three books went to number one on the New York Times bestsellers list. You know, and I'm pretty confident Truce Bakura went very high as well. All of these books at this time tended to, you know. But you're right, it was a romp. It was an adventure. It was, you know, Han and Leia bantering with each other. Luke obviously now knows he's not going to get anywhere with his sister, so Luke's going to look elsewhere, and he's not going to kind of... He kind of does, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you get the Anakin moment with Leia, and you know, there's lots of little moments in this that now people would sort of, because everyone's so damn cynical these days, would just raise their eye. And also, everyone's had so much Star Wars since this. This was kind of innocent in a way because you think back to when Truce came out. What other Star Wars novels were there? Well, there was Han Solo at Star's End, Revenge, Lost Legacy, the three Lando books, Splinters.
Yeah.
The three Heir to the Empire books and this. So this is really early on in Star Wars novels, original Star Wars novels.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we were lucky at this point of time as Star Wars fans, I think, because we didn't know too much.
Oh, 100%. Now, Kathy wrote this, and it came out in 1993. So there's been two editions. There's been the hardcover edition, which came out in 93. I think they call them hardbacks in the States. And we also have the paperback edition, which has had two since. So it's had one printing in 94 and the one I've got's from 97. This is actually one my mother gave me after I'd been on holidays, and I came back and I think it was working as a chef at the time. And she said, look, you should get back into reading. I found this for like $5. down at the bookstore. I went, oh, Star Wars is back, is it? And that was basically after I'd seen the ad from Dark Horse. So I'm like, okay, that's weird. And literally about 2 days later, I saw the ad about the special editions getting a release. And the news that George was working on a series of films set before Star Wars A New Hope.
Yeah, I think back, a friend of mine, Dave Tree, Dave that is now running for this from Empire 40 coming up 2nd of August, Sunday the 2nd of August, so tune in if you get the chance, lots of good stuff on there. Dave always says, Dave's a huge fan of 90s Star Wars, mm-hmm. and he does say, quite rightly, not the 90s is almost the forgotten decade of Star Wars, because Phantom was so late in the 90s, it's essentially the 21st century with the rest of the prequel trilogy.
Yeah.
But the 90s, apart from obviously the special editions, which was a huge deal and made crazy coin, mm-hmm. The 90s kind of gets forgotten in terms of collectibles. In terms of a lot of stuff, the 90s gets kind of a bad rub. It's almost ignored. This time period that, you know, now, as we were waiting for George to, you know, November 1st, 94, I think he wrote the beginning on his yellow notepad, if I remember, in the dock. You know, and we waited and waited. StarWars.com launches in 96, you know, to promote the special editions, essentially, and then turns its attentions to the prequels. We have a couple of years of sort of hearing whispers, you know, this actor's been cast, that actor's been cast. And all the time, these novels from Bantam, a nice, judiciously poised times rolling out Dark Horse was smashing it. I still miss Dark Horse. I really do miss Dark Horse running the comics. Yeah, it was fascinating because we were looking forward in time from Jedi, which, of course, that's the point of time we consider forward and still do, I guess, even with the sequel trilogy. But then thinking to look back all the way before Star Wars, we'd never gone before Star Wars, was just brilliant, brilliant time.
It really is. In the 90s, too, there was a sense of wonder with Dark Horse, like going back to the Lords of the Sith, back, you know, with Kevin J. Anderson's run on Tales of the Jedi and things like that. There's a real sense of wonder. And we are missing that, folks, right now. We don't have that sense of wonder because, to be honest, I think a lot of the material is too present around the current characters and stuff like that. I do hope in, you know, the coming films and other projects, they're brave enough to go and muck around in different time periods, you know, get down to the Old Republic if they need to, or even go 200 or 300 years past all the events of now and just give us a whole... I mean, the whole idea of buying Star Wars or buying Lucasfilm from George was to do something new. And to be honest, I don't think we've had that yet.
It's weird. I think that in terms of, if you look at, I mean, I'm just slightly off topic from Bakura, but not in a way, because Bakura did do something brave in that he had this, you know, the Sirik invasion, which very much felt like the Nagai invasion from the old Marvel run. There was a kind of a similarity there. But, you know, you've got that, and like you said, you mentioned it has a Star Trek vibe to it. You know, it kind of does, you know, with the mind control, mm-hmm. you know, to power their technology, I forget what it was called. Oh, the entrenchment technology, that was it, mm-hmm. And stuff like that. So, you know, there was more sci-fi elements in this than you would probably normally get. But it was, point being, it was a bit of a step outside the boundaries of what you kind of got used to and didn't feel too off because mm-hmm. the characterizations were so good. You know, and you'd still got characters that you were familiar with and cared about and wanted to see more of, you know. And it was almost becoming like the soap opera. It's like, well, how are Han and Leia's relationship going to progress? And how's Chewie going to deal with it? And what's Luke going to do next? You know, and there was all these little elements to it that, you know, I'm very tempted to go back and read the book fresh for the first time in a long time, mm-hmm. As opposed to relying on my sort of quick notes and memories. But now I think with the current crop of characters, I think Rogue One was beautiful because Rogue One, well, apart from the fact that John Knoll had the idea like 10 plus years ago, so that idea had been rattling around Lucasfilm forever, it was so beautifully judged in terms of fitting in with the original New Hope, with that time period and story. So that was beautifully judged, and I think most people love Rogue One. It's high up on most people's lists, quite rightly. Solo, personally, I adore the film because I always wanted a Han Solo film because he's my guy, and Han and Chewie together are gold. So that worked for me. The sequel trilogy I enjoyed, but it didn't end. And I think Rise of Skywalker had an almost impossible job to sort of feel like it's at least trying to tie everything up. and it did it to a degree. It left it at point. But what I would love to see from the publishers, certainly, is something akin to New Jedi Order, Fate of the Jedi. You know, something, an event. Dark Horse did it with the Vector series. You know, mm-hmm. they would do crossovers and stuff like that. You know, so they go, right, here's our, you know, Star Wars version of Secret Wars, or a big event. It's an event thing. You know, it's there's a banner on those titles, and there'll be 9 titles from 3 authors, and they're telling a big story. And I'd love to see a Finn, Rey, and Poe big story, and have them brave enough to do something like that. We've got San Diego, Comic-Con at Home coming up very shortly, mm-hmm. and there's a publisher's panel, far, far away publisher's panel. For all I know, they might announce something like that, and please, I hope they do. Because this period, the Truce of the Courier period, you've just had Heirs to the Empire, which was, at the time, it was the next trilogy, mm-hmm. essentially. It was, we never thought we'd get 7, 8, and 9. I still say, again, slightly off topic, but 7, 8, and 9 coming out when it did, 2015 starting, was for a whole new generation of fans. And that's right, because that's good business. But in reality, it was my generation of fans who walked out the cinema in 1983 going, well, what happens next? And it's people like me who've waited 30 years to find out what happened next. So it's every bit as much for me as it was for the new fans coming in, because Star Wars is multi-generational, and that's exactly how it should be. But the first people to go, well, what happens in Episode 7, were the kids that walked out the cinema on May 25th, 1983. Mm-hmm. So you know, it had a lot of people to satisfy and a lot of ground to cover. I want them to be brave. I really want them to do something out of their normal, still feel like Star Wars. It's got to feel like Star Wars, but just in terms of a big storyline, whatever that may be. And of course, we know Star Wars went off and that was like, you know, super weapon of the week. You know, we had for years. Almost became a running joke, didn't it? But, you know, if you're going to try and take over the galaxy, you're not going to do it with a pea shooter, are you?
No, that's right. Now, the story of this novel really kicks off with a great thing. And, of course, like the story in The Empire Strikes Back, we have an Imperial probe droid, or probe itself, with a distress call going out to the Emperor. It gets intercepted by the Rebel Alliance itself. It has a message about a lizard-like race of aliens which are going to come down from an outer rim planet. And that one is, of course, Bakura, to invade. But Palpatine is gone, and, of course, the Imperial Navy is all over the shop, scattered to the wind. So Luke Skywalker actually volunteers to take a group and out to intercept these aliens and stop the invasion and save the people of Bakura. So it's a pretty noble sort of, I suppose, almost like a World War II start to a Star Wars thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and like I say, the Empire thing with the probe droids and such. But yeah, I mean, so soon after Endor, and of course at this point we still thought that Battle of Endor was it. The Rebels had won. But actually, when you look into it, you know, there's still an Empire, which of course over the novels became like the Remnants, and you know, you realise that they didn't just disappear overnight just because the Emperor and Vader were gone. There was still an Empire. It was just a bit like a headless chicken for a while. So you know, you still got Imperial forces. It's pre. I mean, I can't remember at this point, were they the Galactic Federation of Free Alliances at this point, or you know, they certainly worked toward, or the GFFA. They certainly worked towards, you know, a new republic. I can't remember if they'd actually established themselves at that. I don't think they had. I think it's just a bit before that. But essentially, they're still the Rebel Alliance. So you know, it's a weird political situation around the galaxy when everyone's sort of looking left and right, up and down, going, well, what happens next? You know, so for them to go out and intercept this drone and find out that, well, that the Emperor, even at this point of time, you know, he's clearly expecting to win at Endor. You know, he thinks he's going to win. He's going to crush the Alliance for once and for all. He's going to either get Luke on his side, who's going to defeat him, and things will carry on, because the Emperor's got all these, you know, messages coming from all over the galaxy. And I spoke about it on something recently about how, you know, actually it was on Star Wars Book Club, about talking about the Chewbacca book, the Wookiee book. You know, the Emperor's getting all these messages come from all over the place. And there's myths and rumours, and there's information, and there's, you know, there's knowledge. And he would have people divine this information and then give it to the Emperor. But the Emperor would still get an incredible amount of information. He's got to decide what leads he follows. So in the Chewbacca and the Forest of Fear book, you know, it's, you know, he hears a myth of an ancient, you know, almost like a Sith witch on a planet, and he wants to investigate and get more knowledge and information because it could lead to something. And in the instance of Truce of Bakura, he's finding out that, you know, the Bakurans have got this issue with the Sea Rook and they're coming in to invade. And that's not just a threat to the Alliance, not just a threat to the Empire, it's a threat to everyone, which of course plays out throughout the book.
Hello, I'm Ahmed Best and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
Really does, but I like that, that, you know, it's two previously engaged forces, so the Imperials and the Rebel Alliance, having to, you know, basically put their differences aside and go, oh, God, here's that Luke Skywalker fella. He's the one that took out our Vader guy, and they still, at this stage, don't know it was originally Anakin Skywalker. That, we'll get to that, obviously, in another novel. But, yeah, they're facing, I think this is almost like a precursor to the Yuuzhan Vong, you know, something completely different. They were trying to give a new villain in there. The Vong obviously did probably a lot better than the Sea Rook in this, but it's interesting because it challenges Luke to the point where Obi-Wan Kenobi actually appears. And, you know, basically he's telling him about the danger of the Sea Rook and how greater the galaxy is, you know, in danger as well with the technology that they have. So it's the technology that's sort of the real threat in this, not their knowledge of Force and all that sort of stuff. But that's where we get, of course, Dev Sibwara, who is a Force sensitive, but has no training. But is also brainwashed into furthering the Sea Ruvi or the Sea Rook people. So it's interesting. We're getting these sort of side characters that are in one novel themselves, but also teach Luke in some ways about other areas of the Force.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird to think that obviously Luke has however much training he has in Empire. And of course, nobody's ever really put the, I don't think even Leland Chi has put his fingers on exactly how long Empire takes place over. It always read to me like it was a good few months. You know, Han and Leia, Chewie and 3PO were in that asteroid for a good long while. You know, you know, and Luke certainly on Dagobah. And also just as a side point, when you watch Empire, I don't think Empire is chronological. I don't think that what you see happening on Dagobah and then in the cave with Han and Leia and then Dagobah and then in the cave, I don't think they're happening in sequence. I think they're sort of happening at slightly different times. I don't think they need to happen in sequence. It almost feels like an editorial choice. They're not necessarily happening at the same time. That's just my read of it anyway. But he had a certain amount of training and then he leaves to go and rescue his friends. So his training stops. And then he comes back in Jedi and Yoda dies. So Luke has obviously done a certain amount of training. He's learned enough out in the world for that year between Empire and Jedi. And now here we are really just after Jedi and Yoda's gone and Ben's a Force ghost and can only impart so much information. Although having seen the sequel trilogy, you kind of think, well, maybe Force ghosts can do more than they could because it's an ebbing flow of you know, experience and knowledge and stuff with the Force. You know, we learn more as we go along, which is great. But yeah, you know, Luke has encounters in this and thinking on to, you know, Crystal Star and Darksaber and stuff. You know, there's other instances in there and you kind of think he's picking up other stuff. He's learning as he goes. He is the last Jedi, you know, which plays forward again, you know, at this point. And this is before the establishment of the Jedi Academy as well. So yeah, it was good in the sense that, you know, like you say, the books gave you information that you could take away, chew over, think about, talk about with your friends in a way that at the moment the current ones don't do to the same level because they're not, then that's not their purpose. This was replacing films, these books. The current books aren't replacing anything. They are what they are. So they do serve different functions in that way, I think.
Oh, they do. They do. And the great thing is, as you mentioned, Luke at this stage knows that Leia is his sister. But let's not say that Luke doesn't get action in this, because he does. When he meets one of the senators of Bakura, and her name is Geriel Captison. And there's a growing sort of attraction and mutual sort of respect there. But she has basically a religious, you know, objection in some ways to the Jedi and how they go. And so she likes Luke, but not what he stands for. So it's interesting sort of interplay. And as you mentioned earlier, too, of course, we get the Anakin Skywalker comes back in spirit form, not to Luke this time, but to Leia. And he's trying to find a sense of forgiveness from her.
I love that. I love the thought of that. That, and again, that is one of the successes, I guess, of the sequel trilogy, is that that Leia kind of gets folded more into the Skywalker legacy than she did before, because all the conversation about, you know, Rey taking the name and all that stuff is a false flag to me. You know, there's the Skywalker lineage and the Skywalker line, and Luke and Leia are that, you know. Leia as much as Luke. It's just that Luke kept the name because he lived on Tatooine with his uncle and, you know, was so far away from trouble that it wasn't an issue. I don't know, Lucas always said, oh, Skywalker's a common name like Smith or Jones. He's like, clearly it's not, you know, but nevertheless, it's, you know, that was that. And Leia gets raised as an Organa, and of course they're twins. You know, Luke's the older twin. Still makes me smile. but yeah, the thought that Leia would learn about Anakin and his good and bad deeds, it kind of always felt that Luke would know everything and Leia just didn't. And this was the start of realising and making it clear that Leia's every bit as entitled to that information as Luke and every bit as receptive to it, even though her and Vader were much more regularly adversarial. You know, she would see him in the Senate. You know what I mean? They knew of each other professionally. You know, it's like Thor in Ragnarok. Ah, it's a friend from work. You know, they knew each other for political reasons, not just because of the reasons that Luke and Vader knew each other. And because Vader doesn't learn about Leia until right near the end. So it's a different sense of regret. You wonder whether Anakin would have done the things he did if he'd realised he had a daughter as well as a son. You know, if you can't be turned, perhaps she can be turned. He's still Darth Vader then. It's like the sequel trilogy. It's like Kylo's still saying all the things that he's saying. But when he becomes Ben, it's like, that's the other guy. You know, it's the banner thing again, isn't it? So there's all these lovely little angles to it, and I do love that Anakin feels that he needs to sort of make it right with Leia to a degree, because he never knew until the end, and she certainly never knew. So, yeah, it was a good little moment, that.
Yeah, it's sort of a sense of closure, at least for the character of Anakin. I think, you know, he doesn't have that connection with Luke because he really didn't have... he had obviously the fights with Luke and he had those sort of moments here and there with the temptation and stuff like that. But Leia and Vader had an actual history through the politics and obviously meeting them, you know, with the Death Star and stuff like that. So she's actually known Vader quite well from that persona of him. But to sort of put that flip on it, you know, he feels that that's the connection to his family that he needs to really, you know, take hold of. What I really want to know is, in another story, is where the hell does Shmi come from? Because at the end of the day, that's the story I want to know. Shmi Skywalker, we don't know anything about her. We really don't.
Yeah, that's true. And I was in a Twitter thread the other day, quite an interesting Twitter thread, and this came up. And it made me think, you know, you look back at things that Lucas always said was off limits, you know, Ben's homeworld, Yoda's species, Han and Chewie meeting, and think, you know, the Sabacc game. Well, of course, we've got the Sabacc game and Han and Chewie meeting in Solo, so that's been ticked off the list. You kind of feel like you're going to get to the Yoda questions in The Mandalorian the way it's going. Flippantly came up with the name Stewjohn in a TV interview years ago for Obi-Wan's homeworld, but nevertheless... You still feel there's certain things that are on that list, and Shmi is definitely on that list because, you know, she says, you know, to Qui-Gon, when he says, who's the father? Oh, there is no father. You know, I was pregnant, I gave birth. I can't explain what happened. You know, she doesn't know. So there's a story there, and we kind of fill the gaps in with the whole Palpatine thing. And even more meat on the bone through Rise of Skywalker, which was, of course, touched on for Rey and her line. But for Shmi, yeah, it's like, where did she come from? Is she a Skywalker by birth? You know, she's Shmi Skywalker. So, you know, what's her history there? You know, there's definitely a big story to be told there. I really hope someone at some juncture either does a novel or a series of novels or something, you know, to give more history to her, because she's almost a tragic character, because obviously the way she goes out in Attack of the Clones is just awful. But, yeah, I agree with you. There's definitely a story there.
James Luceno, Plagueis!
I thought you were choking then.
No. I don't know what I said, folks, but I might have said, Darth, Plagueis. There you go, folks. Yep, I'm going to say it. That is the book you need to read. Yeah, I need a doctor too. But yeah, honestly, well, at least this took some of the threads and, you know, I think gave at least a bit of sense of wonder there too. So obviously, you know, Luke attempts to turn people over to the Sea Rook in exchange for their retreat and stuff like that. So there's a little bit of kidnapping involved. Obviously, we get a little bit of that too. But the great thing about it is we get a sense of the New Republic in this too. So let's have a look at some of the characters. Obviously, we talked about the Senator, Geriel Captison. We've got Willick Nurus, which is one of the other characters Luke tangles with. Princess Leia, Dev Sibwara, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Anakin Skywalker, Luke, of course, Han Solo, and I hope I'm saying this right, Peter, Thanos, Wedge, obviously is in this too. He's got quite a good role in it. And, of course, we have the two dynamic duo of R2-D2 and 3PO. Actually, quite good in this, those two get a bit of screen time.
Yeah, well, it was always good to see R2-3PO in everything. And there's a little part of me thinks that it doesn't feel like Star Wars if one or the other's not in it. You know, and they did such a good job in the prequel trilogy. They did that neat thing where, you know, 3PO would be with Padme or R2 would be with Anakin. You know, Obi-Wan and his own droids, because Obi-Wan couldn't have R2 or 3PO really, because he would have remembered them in Star Wars. So they did that neat thing of sort of separating them. But they always gave them, they were always there. And in the sequel trilogy, again, you know, well, not so much R2, because obviously he'd switched off, but 3PO, you know, is dotted through The Force Awakens and a little bit in The Last Jedi. And then to me, pretty much steals The Rise of Skywalker. It was my favourite 3PO performance and favourite 3PO sort of film, if you like, Rise of Skywalker. So you know, you need them in there. You need their perspective. And again, it's back to George, isn't it? You know, George says, well, R2 saw everything. R2 recorded everything. You know, I can't remember where I read it. It was probably mega early days of the internet. But, but some quote that he said that, you know, I like to think that the story of Star Wars is being told, you know, 2,000 years in the future by R2, sort of his last, you know, thing that he did was impart the story of Star Wars to somebody, you know. A bit like, you know, originally it was always one of the original ideas for A New Hope was that it was a Wookiee reading, a bit like Princess Bride, you know, reading the story to her, her young Wookiee as a bedtime story, you know. And it's R2's seen the whole lot. You know, if you go forward 100 years, R2 will be there in some form, you know. Hopefully freshly spruced up and looking good, because he deserves that. But, you know, he's still going to be knocking around, because these droids can last for centuries, can't they? If they're, maintained. But, you know?
Well, most cars can. Yeah. I mean, it's just like a car. It's a piece of machinery. As long as you keep it lubed up, keep the oil in there, you know, it's one of those things that's always there. Now, can you remember, without looking at it, who the dedication this novel went to?
I cannot, not off the top of my head. I can subtly try and cheat, because I've got the book right with me.
Should I give you a hint that James Semple might just love this guy?
That's not James Horner, is it?
No. John Williams.
Ah, oh, well, that makes sense. So, oh, where's the dedication? I can't find it in it.
It's right at the start. She says, "I can't think of Star Wars without remembering the opening fanfare from the original soundtrack. I can't imagine an Imperial Star Destroyer's long triangular silhouette without hearing the ominous triplet rhythms. And who can picture the Mos Eisley Cantina without that imitable jazz band? It is with grateful admiration that I dedicate this novel to the man who composed the musical scores for Star Wars movies, John Williams."
Ah, there you go. I've just found it. I couldn't flick the page open. Yes, there it is. Yes. No. Well, who better to dedicate a book to him. And really, I think about all the stuff I do on the site and everything, and pretty much all of it is with Williams, or currently John Powell and Giacchino, but mostly John Williams playing in my ears. So, yeah, that's a very well-chosen dedication, yeah.
It really is. And, I mean, in this, even in this version, folks, that I've got, we have ads for Michael Stackpole's Rogue Squadron, Wedge's Gamble, the Kritos Trap, or the Kritos Trap.
Yeah.
The Back to War.
Yeah.
Oh, God, they were good. To me, the Rogue Squadron ones were Top Gun. I mean, it really is Top Gun.
Yeah.
I don't think I've read these is the Black Fleet Crisis. I've got them, but I don't think I've read them before.
that Michael C. McDowell, was it?
Yeah, Michael P. Cube McDowell, yeah.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. No, I never read those either. As the years went on, you know, and as the more and more novels came out, because I'm trying to think, well, I think the next novel was Courtship of Princess Leia after Joseph Bakura, if I remember. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts to get more and more and more and more and more books, you know, and so it was harder and harder to keep up. And also Dark Horse were doing so much more, and, you know, you move into the 90s and you know, Insider got busier and everything was just ramping up. So, but yeah, Black Fleet was one. I think I own them, but I don't think I read them, to be honest. But the X-Men, I certainly read the first four or five X-Men books, if not more, and they were great. And of course, they were complemented so well by the Dark Horse series as well. I love the Dark Horse series.
That was a great run.
Loved it.
Oh, yeah. They were fantastic. But I think, too, with that period was, you know, I got heavily into the anthologies that Kevin J. Anderson was just pumping out. He was doing Jedi Search and at the same time getting all these authors to sort of contribute. And he was really, in some ways, the Kevin Feige back then of the, you know, well, he's another Kevin. Oh, there you go. but you know, he was getting all these people together to stay in the same universe. So obviously he was sort of following on the heels of Timothy Zahn and then taking that sort of, I suppose, the thunder and putting it into, you know, Mos Eisley Cantina, and then we get Bounty Hunter ones. And then they then pushed out, we got the books, the Bounty Hunter trilogy, you know, Hard Merchandise, all that sort of stuff. You know, these were great little series of books. And, of course, we got my favourite of the Kevin J. run, which is Darksaber.
He edited a lot of those books at the time, didn't he? He was really front and centre with so much. And the Illustrated Star Wars universe with Ralph McQuarrie as well,
mm-hmm.
which was gorgeous. So good. Yeah. Yeah, good days. There was so much content coming out then, though. It was, and of course, the West End was still releasing the books as well.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, as well as all the other stuff, you still got a steady flow of West End game stuff, and there was content in those as well.
And yes, as asked to me by one of my game players here, we still got an RPG group that gets together every 3 months or so. We get together, and this group is sort of sold by West End books and go, oh, far out, you got the whole collection. I said, all but one of the RPG supplements. And he's gone through, he's gone, oh, this is, you must have paid like a few $100 for that. I said, no. I pay $20 for the lot. And that's true. Yeah. It's very true. West End at the time, we had Wizards coming out, and there was a little book exchange that had basically taken in a box of Star Wars books. There was a lot of ones already had, so a lot of the paperbacks and a lot of Alan Dean Foster's stuff in there, and then there was the old Marvel comics, which I wasn't really interested into. But then I saw the RPGs and went, how much you want for the lot? And he goes, well, I don't know. What are RPG books worth? I said, $20. He said, yeah, $20 it is. There you go.
Nice deal.
Yeah. And a great game that had all Ralph's stuff in there. Had all of his original concepts and stuff like that that weren't used in Return of the Jedi. So obviously, I don't think he stayed on for all of Return of the Jedi, but Joe Johnson's stuff's in there too, and the Rebel source book as well. And you got that Clone Wars vehicle, the Clone Wars era, the six-track tank vehicle that we saw in Kashyyyk. Yeah, the ATAC. Yeah, that is in those books as well.
Yeah, I mean, they were absolute gold. I mean, for us, you know, we used a lot of our own planets and characters, mm-hmm. and so developed a lot of stuff, but it was all inspirational. And it was great for the GM because then he could, you know, John Hicks, I mean, he could just throw in stuff from the books if he was just thinking of something in a pinch, and it all just worked. It was, yeah, happy days. I miss that era. I really do.
Same. I mean, that's it's such a golden era. And I think, you know, without any movies, without anything on TV and vice versa, they had to supplement our Star Wars imaginations with these great books. But I think this, for me, is a big solid 3.5 out of 5. It is solid entertainment. It really gets you going after Return of the Jedi. And, folks, it's not a massive book. It's only about 300 pages, so you can knock this over in one night and really get onto the next one after that.
Oh, absolutely. Like I say, I've got the book out now for us to do this, and I'm looking through it thinking, you know, I might just have a bash through this. I'm quite keen to dive back into it now, and I think if I do that, I might just... Yeah, I might just have a bit of an old reread of certain novels and refresh the memory. Should be fun.
That's right. One of those ones we're going to be doing very soon here, folks, is jump into the old canon. So even before this new canon came up, that is, of course, Han Solo trilogy by Brian Daley. I'm going to be looking at, and of course, I haven't actually read these in many years. I think I've only read the first book, and that was hard enough to find back then. But now, thanks to the Legends line, they're actually re-releasing some of these under the new imprint, and
yeah,
I'm getting all three. I've also got the Lando series on the way too, which I'm really looking forward to reading. I've never read those.
Oh, they're far out, they are. I remember when they came out, I think the first one came out June 83, so it was literally just after Jedi. My local bookstore ordering them in, and they never did, well, it was quite a few years later, they did. I think Boxtree did a print here in the UK, but they were the original American Del Rey prints, so they were the first actual American prints that I got with the Lando books. But the Han Solo novels, blimey. I mean, I haven't read them. I did a reread of as much as I could about 20 years ago, probably a bit longer, starting off with Star's End. And Star's End, when I was a kid, I mean, that came out in 79, I think. And 79, and I must have read that book 30, 40 times when I was a kid.
Nah, great series, and good to see that even now we're getting a love for those books, and follow us here, folks, because we're going to be doing more in this series. Mark and I will be looking at a lot of these in the upcoming. I mean, I'd love to have you on that Han Solo episode, Mark.
I'd love to. Absolutely love. Any excuse to go back into those books works for me. I'd love to.
Definitely. Now, where can the folks at home catch you on the web to chat Star Wars and more?
You can always find me at FantaTrax, and on all social media, it's at FantaTrax. But if you want to find me, not that you would, but if you ever do, it's Prefect, P-R-E-F-E-C-T, Prefect _ timing, to my little Hitchhiker's reference. And generally on Twitter, just noodling about, liking and sharing and making silly comments and dad jokes. So come and say hi.
Awesome. Go and check it out. You can catch me at The Leather Mother on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. And also you can find me at FanthaTrax.com, where I'm the Fantha from Down Under. Go and check that out. All your Star Wars news in a single file. And catch both of us at Fandom Podcast Network. So that's at FanPod Network, where we do Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast, where we want to chat about Picard and his Earl Grey tea. I can't think of a more boring tea to have. You have a tea, have a English breakfast tea. A cuppa. Yeah. You guys call it a cuppa over there, don't you?
You do.
I'm going to get the lingo. And when we go out for lunch, we're going for a curry, guys. I'll be see you later.
You make me hungry now, you bugger.
So stay tuned for that, folks. It's going to be really good. And we have having hopefully Matt soon on here. So Matt Booker, chat some, maybe some comics, actually. It would be probably more down his line, where he's obviously he's with his great shop that he has there in the UK, and talk a little bit of merch. That'd be great, because that's right up his tree, isn't it?
It totally is, yeah. That'll be a fun one. He knows his stuff, he really does. He's got some great stories.
Very passionate when it comes to the memorabilia too, we know that. And, of course, we're hoping to have Brian on soon and chatting books, because let's face it, his massive passion is the literature.
Yeah, it completely is. Yeah, it really is. And, again, very knowledgeable guy who's got a long history with Star Wars literature. So, again, it should be a fun episode with Brian.
Definitely. Now, we also have a Fantha all the way from Brazil that's going to be on an episode very soon. We're going to talk about a movie that's very similar to Star Wars, that is pretty much the Roger Corman knockoff, and that is, of course, Battle Beyond the Stars. And we're going to be doing that with Sergio.
Oh, wicked. That's awesome. That would be great to hear Sergio. He's a good guy and always puts good content on the site as well. And Battle Beyond the Stars, blimey. I used to watch that film to bits as a kid. And not just because the spaceship looked like a pair of boobs.
We literally do get the world's real version of the Millennium Falcon with, of course, the leader of the A-Team running it.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Was he the cowboy?
He was the cowboy in it. Yeah, and you had, who was the guy from, the man from Uncle, and he was in Magnificent Seven. Yeah, Robert Vaughn. Yeah. So he's in it, literally playing exactly the same. Walton. Yeah. But he's playing exactly the same gunslinging character from The Magnificent Seven, but in space in this one.
Yeah. Oh, no, that was a good film. Well, it wasn't. It was a terrible film, but it was just great fun. It's great fun. I'd love to see that again. It's been way too long. I might hit Amazon a bit and order myself a copy because that was so daft. It was brilliant.
Well, it's taken me 12 years to find a DVD copy because it's just not available out here.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. Okay. I might have a, I like a challenge. I'll figure something out.
So, folks, go and check those out. Check us out at fanthatracks.com. We'll catch you very soon in your end of the galaxy. Bye for now. Well, that's all we have time for here tonight on the Fantha from Down Under. And we'll catch you next time, same place, same channel, and of course, with more Star Wars news in a single file from FanthaTracks.com's Australian edition. That's right, we'll catch you next time. So, until then, may the Force be with you, and enjoy your Star Wars fandom. We'll see you next time.
Warning, no Tauntauns were harmed in the filming and recording of this podcast.
Coming up next on Fantha Tracks Radio, it's Making Tracks.